From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Split show for you tonight. Later, communicating with animals, and in a moment, ghostly stories related to law enforcement. Here's what's happening. Nestle, yep, the candy company, is using GPS inside its candy bars to track its customers. The candy company launched the We Will Find You campaign in the United Kingdom, where GPS tracking devices were placed inside 6 candy bars. Once the winning candy bar wrapper is open, the tracking device will go off, and Nestle officials will be able to find the exact location of the customer. It's a big contest, I guess, $16,000 to the winner. Interesting breaking story tonight. The FBI and local police in Michigan plan to take soil samples from the backyard of a house in the Detroit suburb of Roseville. Acting on a dying man's tip that the body of former Teamster President Jimmy Hoffa might be buried there. Authorities have chased down hundreds of would-be leads since Hoffa disappeared 37 years ago after he was to meet with 2 top mafia operatives at a restaurant in Bloomfield Township, another Detroit suburb. In July of 1977, all have led to dead ends, but authorities said this lead could be different. It's been reported that an unidentified man who is dying from cancer told Roseville police that he saw men moving a black bag at the garage of the house just hours after Hoffa went missing. Acting on the tip, the authorities ran radar tests last week that picked up an image of something buried beneath a cement slab in the backyard. We shall see. 31 states plus Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico have abolished corporal punishment, spanking in public schools. But states like Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Texas, Wyoming, and several others still allow it. In 1976, more than 1.5 million public students were paddled, according to reports. 223,000 students in 2005-2006. Now, back in 1977, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that spanking or paddling by school is lawful where it had not been explicitly outlawed by local authorities. Constitutional lawyer Jonathan E. Moore with us. Jonathan, what do you think of all of this corporal punishment?
Well, I think corporal punishment is an archaic and brutal way of treating children. I understand they're unruly children, but there are methods that are less draconian, such as suspension or in-school suspension or positive behavioral support. Just yesterday, George, in 4 Marion County, Florida, school board members, including a recently elected school board member, Carol Ellie, announced that they favor reinstating corporal punishment in the county. It was banned in the county in 2010. And also in Springfield, Texas, the Springfield, Texas High School District voted to expand its corporal punishment program to permit opposite gender spankings and paddlings. That after a male vice principal spanked a 15-year-old female student, Taylor Santos, so hard that it bruised her. It's another important fact here, George, and that is that students with disabilities are paddled at nearly twice the rate as those without.
I think I'd be very upset as a parent, Jonathan, in those days if anybody had spanked my kids.
Well, that's right. And, you know, my own father used to give me a note. I didn't know what it was. To give to the teacher saying, don't spank my child. And when I was in the third grade, I was spanked with, despite the note, and my father, who was a professional boxer, decked my gym teacher for doing that.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jonathan. Jonathan's website, emord, emord.com. Magician David Blaine said he will risk electrocution for his latest stunt. The master illusionist plans to have a 1 million volt charge surge through his body nonstop for 72 hours. His latest death-defying stunt called Electrified will take place in New York next week. He'll be standing on a pedestal wearing a futuristic mesh suit and a globe-shaped wire helmet as electrical bolts hit him from all directions. He said that he will stand between 2 electrodes and allow 1 million volts to flow through his grounded body. Any disruption in the stream could stop his heart. The event will be streamed live over the internet. Andy Williams, whose easygoing charm and smooth rendition of Moon River here propelled him to the heights of music stardom in the early 60s. He has died at his home in Branson, Missouri, following a battle with bladder cancer. He was 84 years old. 2012 had marked his 75th year in showbiz. Williams survived by his wife, Debbie, and his three children. 17 gold and 3 platinum records to his name. Williams enjoyed his golden years playing golf and dividing his time between California and Branson, where he appeared at his Andy Williams Moon River Theater since 1992. He was on the stage of the theater in November of 2011 when he announced he had bladder cancer. At that time, he assured fans this disease was no longer a death sentence and that he had every intention of being a survivor. Andy Williams, dead at the age of 84, and actor, singer, and just a giant in showbiz himself, Pat Boone with us here. Pat, a sad story to see someone of this caliber go.
Yeah, it is. You know, he was 84 years old, which, of course, we consider a ripe old age, but the older we may get individually, the more it seems like his life was cut short. He has a brother too that are older, and in fact, he used to be the baby of the bunch. So he comes, as Arthur Godfrey used to say, from a family of long livers. He said, "My father's liver was this long."
I love it.
But Andy, one of the consummate singers of our day, a fine guy, a good friend of mine. We knew each other 40 years, and we laughed, we played golf, we sang together. He was not only a guest on my first early television show, I was the youngest guy ever to have his own network show, and Andy was a guest several times while he was appearing with Steve Allen on his various shows, and he was so good that I took a summer off. Remember, we used to do 39 live shows.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And then we'd keep the time slot and have somebody fill in during the summer. And so we asked Andy to take over the show for the summer, which he did, and it was his first TV hosting job. Next summer, it was Dick Van Dyke, who also, it was his first hosting job, too. So I was helping a couple of fantastic performers really get their feet solidly on good ground for their careers, and I was proud of that. But Andy was most grateful to me because when Henry Mancini wrote Moon River for the movie Breakfast at Tiffany's, mm-hmm. he and the head of Dot Records came over to see me one afternoon to play me a demo of the song with a choral group and Henry's own arrangement, Mancini, and played it for me. And I said, "Boy, you know, this is a very pretty song, but it's not a love song. It's about a river." And we've already got up the Lazy River. We've got Suwannee River. We've got Old Man River.
Yeah.
And so I don't think we need another river song. So he left my house, idiot that I was, and went over to Andy Williams' house, who immediately loved it. And Andy was grateful to me ever after.
It just zoomed after that. How difficult, Pat, was it in those days for singers to really make it big? Because I know, and I've got to talk with you at a later date about Bobby Darin. I'm starting to get into his life, and I know you knew him well.
I knew him very well. Yeah.
But how difficult was it for people to break in those days? I mean, we didn't have like American Idol and all these things to fuel it today.
Well, in a funny way, George, it was easier.
Really?
Because a guy, and I know of a number of examples of this, could make a record in his garage, and he could take it to a radio station. And I'm thinking of a guy named, there was a guy named Key Luke who made a version of a song about Telstar, I think it was. It was just like two instruments and a commercial melody. And he had a huge record with it. Another guy, actually, I can't think of what it was, the song at the moment, but he recorded it in his bedroom playing a beat-up guitar and his dad making drum sounds on pencils in his
Amazing.
Pocket. And they'd play it, they'd get a DJ to play it. If it caught on, it became a big hit. And that happened, hundreds of times where artists would just get hold of somebody with a record company and in a parking lot or a garage or in a waiting room somewhere or in a barber shop and get them to listen to a song, and boom, it could be a big hit.
He was a star after that.
Today, even if you go through something like American Idol or The Voice, if you and you wind up being a runner-up or even a winner, you've got to be with a record company with a huge marketing machine. They've got to what do they call it when you poll delegates, kind of you test market songs and I mean it's a very expensive thing for record companies to put out a record, and you can have a hit overnight and you hurry to manufacture and try to fill the orders, and you get in debt doing it, and then you don't have the next hit, and you're out of business.
Well, it's amazing what you and people like Andy Williams were able to accomplish, Pat. Thank you. Pat's website, patboone.com. Amazing. And, of course, our Gary Patterson, our published author, Take a Walk on the Dark Side and The Walrus Was Paul and Hellhounds on the Trail. Gary, you're an expert. You've followed people in this business just all the time. Pat Boone, a dear friend of ours, Andy Williams gone at the age of 84. What can you say about comparing those singers of that era to those today?
Well, you know, I think it was The Voice. You know, everybody talks about American Idol and the show The Voice, but when you heard Andy Williams, his voice was so distinctive. I guess if I had to come up with an adjective, I'd say it was smooth. It was just very smooth when you heard him. And when you saw him on television and he performed, and of course, you're talking about pop music. I think he started in the early 60s, which was right before the Beatles. And yet, you know, he had variety television shows. And George, when I think of him, and I think of Andy Williams, I think of him wearing that trademark red sweater with the V-neck.
Yep.
You know, that Christmas.
And that smooth voice.
It was a smooth voice. And he was a crooner. And today, you don't have crooners. I mean, you had Perry Como, you had Andy Williams, you had that sound. And it was pop songs. And, you know, they stayed true to the art form. And, you know, here he was in his 80s, and he performed in his 70s. And, you know, he still had that voice. And, you know, it's going to be something that's going to be greatly missed. And no matter exactly what type of music you like, it's just the smooth sound of Andy Williams will be missed because nobody else had that sound.
The one great thing about albums and records and CDs and digital and everything else, they live forever, don't they,
Gary? They live forever.
I love it. Thanks, Gary. Stay in touch with us. Up next, a crime scene investigator. We're going to talk about ghost stories in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, split show for you, first couple hours, Paul Ramosh with us, of course, he was with me about a year ago. Paul has graduated from Weber State University, Bachelor of Science in Criminalistics. Paul has spent the last 14 years plus working as a crime scene investigator for the Weber Metro CSI, active in forensic science education, law enforcement training. Looking forward to this. Paul, welcome back. How are you?
Oh, great. It's good to be back on the show, George. So
I either have a very clairvoyant executive producer or she's got a great calendar, because it has almost been exactly a year since you were last with me.
That's true, and I know you love to talk about ghost stories.
I do.
To get to Halloween.
And nothing like October and ghosts, Paul. How have you been? What have you been up to for the last year?
Well, I've been collecting more ghost stories, talking to the officers I work with, and also this summer I've been working on a blog tour for my book, The Lost Stones, trying to get it out there on lots of blogs and get some reviews done. So just keep them busy, enjoying life.
Well, that's good. That's good indeed. Let's talk a little bit about life as a crime scene investigator. You know, I just had the story about they think they might have found the bones finally of Jimmy Hoffa. They are not sure. They're going to check tomorrow. They're going to do some digging. But as a crime scene investigator, how the heck would you handle that?
Well, I've been able to work on a few digs myself, and I mean it's very similar to an archaeological dig. When you go in and you have a site where you think there might be some human remains, you don't just go in with a shovel and start tossing dirt. You really go in layer by layer, and you sift and you document as you go. And so it's digs can be really challenging, but they're also very interesting work as well.
Oh, it sure has. Now, you know, in your crime scene investigating, let's talk a little bit about some of the things that you've been on, some of the cases that you have been on, and how you weigh that with the unusual, the paranormal. Did that ever, you know, raise its head and become a problem?
Well, I don't think so. We work really closely with death, and, you know, maybe that sounds a little grandiose, but I mean, it's something that day in and day out is part of our job we deal with. And so you're never too far away from it. And most police officers and crime scene investigators that I know do believe in an afterlife and do believe in paranormal things. And, you know, after I was on the show and, you know, a lot of the feedback from people, I mean, it was even more than I realized before. And so it's when we're on a death investigation or doing things like that, I mean, you are trying to communicate in a way with this person. You want to know what happened. You're studying what happened to them to bring about their death. And yeah, it is a very almost, I don't know if spiritual experience is the right word to use, but you're really trying to reach out to them.
What came first, Paul, your belief in the paranormal or the scientific training?
Well, I think as a child, before I even decided I wanted to go into forensics, I loved ghost stories. And my good friend Art, he, as I think about him growing up together, he was probably the first person who told me a ghost story from around the neighborhood. And I've always just had a fascination with that. And then as I became received my education in criminalistics and forensic sciences, and you'd think those would be kind of opposing views, that, you know, the scientific view disregards the paranormal in many cases. But as the crime scene investigator, we're trained in forensics to go where the evidence takes you, to not get tunnel vision, to not jump to conclusions, to not make assumptions. You have to go where the evidence goes. And so as you hear stories and have experiences and see all these things, it's hard to disregard the spiritual world.
When word got out that you were interested in the unusual and paranormal, did some of your colleagues start sharing stories with you?
They did. And it started a few years ago. It was around Halloween. And, you know, as we mentioned, around, you know, in October, you want to talk about those things. And so I just started to ask. And this was before last year when I was on, just ask the officers as we go out on crime scenes. And you enjoy talking, and while you're working, you know, the camaraderie is one of the really wonderful things about the job and sharing stories. And I would just start to ask, hey, have you ever had any ghost stories with work, or have you ever seen anything like that? And officers were just more than willing to share. And yeah, no one that I've ever talked to about it has looked down or thought it was strange. They've all really enjoyed it.
Tell me a little bit more about some of your paranormal experiences, Paul.
Well, I would say I haven't really personally had a lot in my crime scene work. I've collected a lot of stories. I mean, there was one homicide that I worked that does have an interesting ghost story attached to it. But while we were working on the scene, and it was a really bloody homicide, stabbing multiple times, a really horrible scene. But while we were there working the scene, and we were there almost every day for about 2 weeks, when we would go in in the morning to work, you could feel the victim's presence there. And it got to the point where everybody would start to essentially greet her when they would walk in the door. And it wasn't a bad feeling. It was a calm feeling, but you could tell she was there and she knew what we were doing to help. And the interesting story that's attached to that is after the scene was, it was in an apartment complex, and after that scene was cleaned up and rented out, and it was probably about a year or so later, one of the officers who worked the case, named Mike, went back to that exact apartment on a completely unrelated matter. It was a noise complaint.
Mm-hmm.
That the people who live there were complaining about some of their neighbors who were playing loud music. And that's a common call for officers.
Sure.
In apartment complexes. And when he got there, he took the report and, you know, did his business. And the woman who lived there said, hey, officer, did something bad happen in the apartment?
Let's pick that up when we come right back, Paul. I bet something bad did happen there. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Paul Ramosh with us as we talk about law enforcement and ghost stories. We'll also talk a little bit about Forbidden Archaeology with Paul. We'll take your phone calls with him next hour with our split show. Paul, let's go back and talk a little bit more about that crime scene paranormal experience.
Okay, so as I said, there was a pretty gruesome homicide there, and then the scene was, you know, we were done, and they cleaned it up and rented it out again, and an officer responded, and I think it was about a year later, he responded back to take a noise complaint, and he'd actually worked the case, and so he felt a little odd going back in there knowing what had happened. And once he had concluded the police business with the lady, she asked, did something bad happen in these apartments? And he said, well, yeah, you sure you want to know? And she said, well, yeah. He said, well, there was a homicide. And she said, well, which apartment was it in? And he said, well, this one.
Yours.
Yeah, yours, exactly. And she said, oh, okay, well, that makes sense. And then kind of left it at that. And he was dying to know what was going on. And so he asked her, and she said, well, down the hall, the bathroom light will just always turn on by itself. It'll be off, and I know it's off, and I'll go back there, and it'll be on. And knowing what he knew about the case, that the woman had been killed right there by the bathroom. And, you know, the person who lived there didn't seem that concerned about it, but he kind of left with chills because having known what happened. So it's just one of those things where, you know, if you're saying, well, where's the evidence for paranormal? I mean, she had no idea what had gone on or where it had gone on, but she pretty much described where the murder happened. So it was a really compelling story.
Would you live in a home that somebody had died in or was murdered in specifically?
No.
Either would I. If I knew about it, I would not. I mean, like, I'm wondering how that poor family, they've been in this house for 15 years in Roseville, Michigan, where the bones of Jimmy Hoffa could be buried in their backyard. That's got to be weird.
I don't know. With someone as famous as Jimmy Hoffa, they might be able to charge admission and
that's true.
Come look,
so. They could make if the city will let them, they could make a small fortune doing that.
Yeah, for sure. But, I mean, there does seem to be, when something violent, a suicide or a homicide or something, there does often seem to be the paranormal imprint left behind. And I have another story that just kind of I've recently discovered or recently been told from our intern, Shanae. And one of her relatives was living in an apartment again, another apartment complex, not the same one, but another apartment complex. And one night after she had moved in fairly recent, or not long after she moved in, she woke up in the middle of the night and looked towards her door, and there was this silhouette of a man in her door. And it was silhouetted. She couldn't really make out any features, but she could tell that he looked bald and fairly well built. Well, she thinks that someone has broken into her apartment. And so she starts to scream, and she has a dog, and the dog jumps up on the bed and looks towards the door and starts barking. And so she reaches over and flicks the light on, and he's gone. And so she gets out and kind of carefully looks around the corner, doesn't see anything, checks the doors, checks the windows. Nobody's there. And so this starts to happen to her more and more. He only appeared in that doorway. And she, when she was in her room, she would look over sometimes and see him there and kind of turn away and look back, and he would be gone. And so this went on, and it was kind of disconcerting to her, but she was kind of coping with it and dealing with it. Well, one day she was in the bathtub taking a bath, and she has a 7-year-old daughter, and she left the door open so she could hear her daughter playing. And her daughter was playing on a little toy phone. It wasn't a real phone. It was like one of those Barbie phones.
Yeah, little plastic thing.
Yeah, no electronics, nothing at all, just a toy phone. And so she's pretending to talk to someone on the phone, and she's having this conversation, and the mother laying in the bathtub can hear this whole conversation. And so suddenly the girl says, well, let me put you on speakerphone so you can talk to my pet rat. And as soon as the daughter says that, the mother in the bathtub, clear as day, hears a male voice say, hello. And it freaks her out, and she jumps out of the tub and grabs a towel and looks around, and no radio's on, no TV's on, nothing like that that could have made that noise is on. And so she freaks out, and she grabs her daughter, and they moved out of the apartment and didn't go back for a while.
I don't blame her.
Yeah, it just really frightened her. Just seeing was one thing, but hearing that voice really, really did it to her. And so she eventually, the story kind of, it's we often hear researchers in the paranormal say that ghosts can't hurt you. And in this case, the ghost didn't hurt her, but she hurt herself, because when she finally moved back into the apartment, she was laying in bed one night and once again looked up and saw him standing in the doorway, and went to get out of bed to turn the light on, and her foot got tangled in the blankets, and she fell down and broke her wrist.
Jeez.
And, yeah, she hasn't been back since. And so kind of in the meantime, when all this was going on, she started to do a little bit of checking and found out that in the apartment right below her, a few years before, a man had taken his own life. He had killed himself with a shotgun, and it was in the apartment right below her. And so she made that connection as well.
What can you say, Paul, about violent crime scenes and the paranormal? Are there strange things that generally will happen?
You know, a lot of times we don't go back and we don't hear the stories. And so the ones that I've been able to collect and talk to people about, it does seem that if there's a violent death, if there's something really tragic that happens, that there is a lot of times a haunting involved or something. And, you know, on coast to coast, you know, all the, you know, I'm not a paranormal researcher. I love to collect these stories. And, the, you know, the great researchers that you have on, they talk about an imprint, that whatever this violent thing or this tragic thing or this intense thing leaves some sort of imprint. And, yeah, it does seem associated with it.
Some of these other hauntings, what do people generally report back, and how do you get the information? I mean, how does it flow to you?
Well, most of the time, like I said, when I'm out with the officers on crime scenes, the way it works here in our county is the officers will respond to a crime scene. They'll decide whether they need the forensic services or not, and they'll call us to it. And so, you know, as we're working, I'll just talk to them and get a lot of the information. And sometimes they know other stories, you know, like the officer who went to that call, and they give them to me. So a lot of times it's just right from the officers themselves.
What's the creepiest place you've ever been to?
Well, there was another homicide we had right around the time as that other one. It was back in 98, and we had a lot of bizarre homicides that year here in our county. And it was a scene where a gentleman was murdered by his roommate. There was multiple weapons used. It was extremely gruesome crime scene. And in the basement of that house, it looked like the basement from the Blair Witch Project. It was stone walls. And when we had to go down there to kind of do photos and videos.
Dark, cold.
Yeah, and that had a really creepy feeling. And probably the next creepiest place was one time there, my buddy Jason and I responded to a burglary at a mausoleum. There was somebody had put a gold watch behind glass where the urn was in this mausoleum, and someone had gone in and stolen the glass or the gold watch. And we were there. It was starting to get dark, and just in this giant mausoleum, very still, starting to get dark. My buddy Jason said, "Have you ever seen that movie Phantasm?" I'm like, "Yeah, the one where the little ball goes around the mausoleum." Yeah, yeah. And that was a really creepy time. We had a laugh, but it was a pretty ominous feeling there.
We're with Paul Ramosh's book, of course, is The Lost Stones. Paul, you've done some work in forbidden archaeology, much like Michael Cremo. It's part of a theme of your work. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, what fascinates me about forbidden archaeology is its relationship to the mainstream sciences, that there are lots and lots of really interesting things out there that defy kind of the conventional notions of things. But because one reason or another, the mainstream of science doesn't want to acknowledge it. And as I've done my research, and once again, I wrote this book, and I'm relying on the shoulders of the greats. You mentioned Michael Cremo, all the...
The giants,
yes. I mean, the people, Eric von Daniken, I mean, the people that have really made this field. And I rely on their research to write and to find source material and different things. And as I've studied it, it's interesting, and I've kind of come to the conclusions that the mainstream of science is essentially a new religion, in that there is the orthodoxy of science that you're not really allowed to depart from. There's almost the equivalent of the priesthood in modern science, where, you know, if you're a Catholic, you can't be baptized by someone who hasn't gone through the seminary and become a priest. Just like in research today, if you don't have the right letters behind your name, PhD, your research, no matter how wonderful it is, will be disregarded by the mainstream of science.
They won't even look at it.
They won't. And probably one of the most compelling stories that illustrates that point, I talk about in the introduction to The Lost Stones. And it's funny that you mentioned Michael Cremo, because this was he essentially kind of resurrected this woman's work. But there's a woman, a scientist named Virginia Steen McIntyre, and her story is it's the textbook example of, if something doesn't fit the orthodoxy of mainstream science, it's buried and ignored. And what happened to Dr. Steen McIntyre is that she was working in a place in Mexico where there had been some really interesting finds. A man who was a local, and his name was Juan Camacho. He was a self-taught scientist. He hadn't been to any universities. He didn't have any letters behind his name, but he had discovered an area where there were fossils and of ice age animals and tools and even spear points driven in some of the bones and markings on the bones. He found this wonderful area, and it was the Vasconcelos Reservoir. There were different, I probably said that wrong. My Spanish is
That's pretty close.
But there were all these finds of like I said, these ice age animal bones and human tools. And the Mexican archaeological establishment at the time pretty much ignored his work.
Ignore it, or they hide it.
Well, they actively fought against him, and we'll kind of get to that later in the story. But so they ignored his work, but eventually foreign archaeologists began to take a look at his work. And so they sent scientists from America came down, and Dr. Steen McIntyre was in charge of using, her specialty was dating archaeological sites based on volcanic ash deposits. And so as she goes along and she's starting to work, the evidence starts to suggest that these sites with bones and human tools could be as old as 20,000 years, 20,000 years ago. But the trouble with that is that the mainstream of science says, well, wait a minute. Anatomically modern humans came across the Bering Strait 14,000 years ago, and that's how they got here. No one else got here by boat or at any other time. And so they started to run into opposition to their work, because this date of 20,000 years was, you know, beyond the orthodoxy. Well, they go on and they start to do more and more work, and they start to discover more and more interesting things, and their research really frightened the establishment. So the Mexican archaeological authorities swooped in on Mr. Camacho and confiscated his work, confiscated his tools, and he was forbidden by law to do any more field work. So they wouldn't even consider his 30 years of research that he had done, because it went against their their theories, because he didn't have the right letters behind his name, they buried it.
Hmm.
Well, as we go along, there started to be more and more harassment with the American archaeologists, even though they did have the right letters behind their name, because they started to find more and more evidence, and there was various sources of dating involved here. There was C-14, there was the different radiometric dating.
Why suppress this, Paul?
Well, that's a good question, and you could say that it's all about power, I guess. I mean, where
or people, fear? What are they afraid of?
I don't know. That's a really good question. I mean, in Dr. Steen McIntyre's own words, she attributes it to jealousy. That if you're in academia, kind of your crowning glory is to be in the history books, that you made this great discovery. Well, if someone comes along and disproves your theory, then you're kind of knocked off that pedestal. And that was kind of her, ideas. Coast to Coast is full of lots of conspiracy theories, that there's other reasons why people would want to suppress the truth. And I mean, I guess your guess is as good as mine, but it's tragic, because what happened to Dr. McIntyre is, with the more and more that they found, the more and more earth-shattering her results were. They eventually concluded that these tools and these animal bones could be as old as 250,000 years old.
And as you know, Cremo talks about mankind being millions of
years. That's right. But the trouble with all that is that the mainstream of science and archaeology says that anatomically modern humans weren't around 250,000 years ago. And so this really disrupts their findings and really shakes the tree. And so because her findings were so drastic, it's really tragic what happened to her, because when she pushed her peer-reviewed papers, to try to get them published, she lost one job at a university and then lost another job, and she became blacklisted. And eventually she was working as a professional gardener. Which sounds wonderful, by the way, when I read that.
It's like, peaceful.
That's probably, that doesn't sound so bad. But her work never really saw the light of day. And it would have died forever, except for Cremo and Thompson had put it in their book, Forbidden Archaeology, and that introduced it to the open-minded people, let's say, the coast-to-coast audiences of the world. That, you know, so she got her day eventually, but not fully accepted. And so that's just a playbook example of what happens to any.
Well, and it happens all the time, Paul. Paul, we're going to take this quick break. We're going to come right back. We're going to take phone calls with you next hour. Split Show with Paul Ramosh, his book, The Lost Stones. He's a criminal investigator, and, of course, he looks at the paranormal side of life. So perhaps you have a question for Paul, or maybe you want to share one of your ghostly stories, kind of a tune-up to Halloween, and wait till we get to that the end of October. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.